Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, December 7th, 2021. President Joe Biden holds a two-hour secure video call with Russian President Vladimir Putin, talking about the rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine. A White House statement after, saying that President Biden made clear that the U.S. and our allies would respond with strong economic and other measures in the event of military escalation. A deal emerging in Congress to raise the federal debt ceiling using only Democratic votes, as Republicans had demanded. On COVID-19, White House Chief Science Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci saying early studies show the Omicron variant may cause less severe illness than other variants, but may also be more transmissible and can more easily infect somebody who has been vaccinated. And today is the 80th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that brought the U.S. into World War II. We'll have part of the ceremony at the National World War II Memorial in Washington. From the New York Times, President Biden, in a high-stakes virtual meeting on Tuesday morning, warned President Vladimir Putin of Russia of economic consequences if he continued to grow a military presence around Ukraine, according to a White House statement. Diplomatic effort came as tens of thousands of Russian troops massed along the Ukrainian border, raising fears of an invasion. The two began their conversation via video link at 10:07 a.m. Eastern, according to the White House. It ended at 12:08 p.m. Also, according to the White House, two leaders discussed ransomware and issues related to Iran. Before the call, Biden officials said the leaders would cover nuclear arms control, cybersecurity, and Iran's nuclear program. Russian media released the first 30 seconds of the video call, and it appears to show a brief connection issue. Here's what it sounds like.
Приветствую вас, господин президент.
There you go.
Hello.
Добрый день.
Good to see you again. Unfortunately, last time we didn't get to see one another at the G20. I hope next time we meet, we do it in person.
President Biden and the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Again, that clip released by Russian media. After the about two-hour call, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan gave an update to reporters in the White House briefing room.
As you all know, President Biden held a secure video call today with President Putin. The call covered a range of issues, but the main topic was Ukraine. President Biden was direct and straightforward with President Putin, as he always is. He reiterated America's support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He told President Putin directly that if Russia further invades Ukraine, the United States and our European allies would respond with strong economic measures. We would provide additional defensive materiel to the Ukrainians above and beyond that which we are already providing. And we would fortify our NATO allies on the eastern flank with additional capabilities in response to such an escalation. He also told President Putin there's another option, de-escalation and diplomacy. The United States and our European allies would engage in a discussion that covers larger strategic issues, including our strategic concerns with Russia and Russia's strategic concerns. We managed to do this at the height of the Cold War, and we developed mechanisms to help reduce instability and increase transparency. We've done this in the post-Cold War era through the NATO-Russia Council, the OSCE, and other mechanisms. There's no reason we can't do that going forward, provided that we are operating in a context of de-escalation rather than escalation. The United States, as we have been for some time, is also prepared to support efforts to advance the Minsk Agreement in support of the Normandy format. This could include a ceasefire and confidence-building measures that helps drive the process forward. As I said before, the discussion between President Biden and President Putin was direct and straightforward. There was a lot of give and take. There was no finger wagging, but the president was crystal clear about where the United States stands on all of these issues. We believe from the beginning of this administration that there is no substitute for direct dialogue between leaders, and that is true in spades when it comes to the U.S.-Russia relationship. So President Biden welcomed the opportunity to engage clearly and directly with President Putin. Indeed, as President Biden said after his meeting in Geneva in June with President Putin, where we have differences, I want President Putin to understand why I say what I say and why I do what I do and how we'll respond to specific kinds of actions that harm America's interests and indeed harm our allies' interests. That's exactly what he did today. After the call, He spoke with the leaders of France, Germany, Italy, and the UK to debrief them on the call and to consult on the way forward. Our team is presently debriefing the embassies of NATO members, EU members, and key Indo-Pacific allies. The president will be speaking shortly with the leaders of both houses of Congress and talking to them about ways in which the administration and the Congress can work together on a bipartisan basis to stand up for American interests and values and stand behind our friends and partners.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the White House briefing room. More from the New York Times article, the virtual meeting with Mr. Putin was a crucial test for Mr. Biden as he tried to protect Ukraine, a Democratic ally whose security U.S. officials have promised to defend and head off a major European security crisis. Mr. Putin has complained that Ukraine poses a threat to Russia through its close military and political ties to the United States and European powers. But Mr. Biden's options are limited. He has no desire to send U.S. troops into battle on Ukraine's behalf. Instead, Mr. Biden was to use the call to warn Mr. Putin of potentially severe economic consequences. That from the New York Times. Maybe not U.S. troops on the front lines in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, but how about nearby, as the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan suggested? A follow-up question.
Could you elaborate on what you just said about fortifying allies on the eastern flank there? Is sending U.S. troops to the region on the table here?
So what I'm referring to there is, in the event that there is a further invasion into Ukraine, a military escalation in Ukraine, obviously many of our partners on the Eastern Front, our Baltic allies, Romania, Poland, other countries, will be increasingly concerned about the security and territorial integrity of their countries. They will be seeking, we expect, additional capabilities and potentially additional deployments, and the United States will be looking to respond positively to those things in the event that there is a further incursion into Ukraine.
So is that something the American public should be bracing for, the possibility of seeing American troops on the ground in that region in the coming weeks and months if Vladimir Putin goes through with this?
I don't know if I would say bracing for, since we currently have rotational deployments in the Baltics. We conduct exercises on a regular basis in both Poland and Romania. The presence of American military service members in rotational fashion in these countries is not something new. The question here is not that about whether or not the United States is going to send American service members to the territory of our NATO allies. We do that as a matter of course. The question is, what additional capabilities can we provide to ensure that they feel strong and confident in their own sovereignty and territorial integrity? It is those additional capabilities that are on the table in those countries should Russia move in Ukraine in a more decisive way.
The National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan with reporters in the White House briefing room. Up on Capitol Hill, Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas taking the opportunity during a debate on the Senate floor about a Biden administration nominee to criticize the president's policy on Russia. After Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, attempted to bring up and confirm the nominee for State Department Chief of Protocol, Rufus Gifford, Senator Cruz objected and said it was because of President Biden's handling of a Russian pipeline that he says led to this current crisis.
The senators in this chamber, including Senator Markey, know precisely why I have a hold on this nominee. Right now, as we speak, hundreds of thousands of Russian troops are massed on the border of Ukraine, waiting to invade. Mr. President, this calamitous foreign policy disaster is Joe Biden's fault. This is the direct consequence of Joe Biden's surrender to Vladimir Putin on Nord Stream 2. What is Nord Stream 2? It is a pipeline being constructed from Russia to Germany to carry natural gas. Putin is building Nord Stream 2. Why? To go around Ukraine, because right now Russian gas goes through Ukraine. Putin didn't just wake up recently and decide to invade Ukraine. He's wanted to invade Ukraine for years. He did so in 2014, but he stopped short of full invasion. Why? Because the Ukrainian energy infrastructure was necessary to get the Russian gas to market. Nord Stream 2 is all about building an alternative avenue to get the Russian gas to Europe, so then the Russian tanks can ride into Ukraine. But, Mr. President, we had a bipartisan victory. Indeed, the senator from Massachusetts supported my bipartisan legislation sanctioning the Nord Stream 2 pipeline in December of 2019. And when President Trump signed that bipartisan legislation into law, Nord Stream 2 was halted that day. Not the next day, not the next week, not the next month. That day, the pipeline shut down. We had won a major bipartisan foreign policy victory. We had stopped Russia. We had stopped Putin. And that pipeline remained dormant for over a year, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the ocean, until Joe Biden arrived at the White House.
Senator Ted Cruz on the Senate floor. He did object to that nomination, chief of protocol at the State Department, and then tried to bring up his own bill to impose sanctions on Russia over the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And Senator Markey objected to that. Meanwhile, elsewhere on Capitol Hill, Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland testifying about U.S.-Russia relations before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The chair is Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, asking about the call today between President Biden and the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Do we have a calculus as to how much pain Putin is willing to subject himself to in order to invade Ukraine, meaning how many lives as Russia's sons are in the mix in terms of particularly a long-term insurgency that would exist by the Ukrainian people rising up?
Chairman, I thought you sent President Putin a very powerful message yourself this morning, that the Ukrainians are a tough nation. They will not stand by should President Putin order his forces into Ukraine or otherwise try to destabilize their democracy in profound ways. I think the Russians will have a very big fight on their hands, that there will be severe casualties for them. And frankly, it's hard to comprehend why at a time when Russia itself has one of the highest rates of COVID around the world and the Russian people are suffering in other ways, Putin would want to spend the money in the Russian treasury, hundreds of millions of rubles, on a war nobody needs with Ukraine rather than on building back better inside Russia, which is what his people are asking for.
Would it be fair to say that because of the mounting Russian troops, which I understand is like close to 170,000 or so amassed along Ukraine's various borders, that in fact it has caused the Ukrainians to have to mobilize in a way that they might not have before?
That's right. With, as I said, close to 100,000 troops now and many, many more planned, the Ukrainians are having to think differently about their own security. And in fact, some of the defensive lethal support that the U.S. has given Ukraine over the years, they've had in storage containers, and I think we'll now see them have to put that stuff out and be thinking very hard about their own civil defense.
Victoria Nuland is Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, questioned by Senator Bob Menendez, who chairs the Foreign Relations Committee. We covered today's hearing, and you can find it in its entirety at our video library at cspan.org. RT, the Russian government-funded news site, puts today's call between President Biden and President Putin this way. They write, the much-anticipated video summit on Tuesday touched a number of topics, including the American accusation that Russia is amassing troops to invade Ukraine, which Moscow has dismissed as fake news. This is Washington Today. From the Hill newspaper, House Democrats on Tuesday introduced legislation that would allow the Senate to raise the debt ceiling without having to overcome a filibuster. The legislation would set up a one-time process to raise the debt limit to a specific number without requiring 60 votes to overcome procedural roadblocks. After that process is established with the help of Republicans, then Democrats are expected to pass the separate debt ceiling increase without any GOP support. That from The Hill. Positive response from the Senate leaders to this idea. First, the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
First, I'm just going to say a brief word on the debt limit. Our concern all along has been doing this through a process that is, we were worried about a process that would be convoluted, lengthy, and risky. And we believe we shouldn't be doing anything that puts our full faith and credit in jeopardy. Our goal has been to increase the debt limit. We want a simple majority without a convoluted, risky, lengthy process. And it looks like the Republicans will help us facilitate that. So we feel very good about where we're headed on debt ceiling. It's not done till it's done. But the idea of letting Democrats carry it ourselves is what we've always said, and that's the direction we are headed in. Okay?
Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, the majority leader with reporters on Capitol Hill. In a separate news conference, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, also saying he supports this plan.
As you already know, and I'm sure have been talking about, the House is going to send over today a bill that prevents Medicare cuts that would otherwise go into effect, and a procedure that Senator Schumer and I have been working on that will allow a truncated consideration of what could be a Section 301 reconciliation proposal, one time only, with a debt, with an amount, and allow the debt ceiling to be dealt with on a simple majority basis at a subsequent time. I think this is in the best interest of the country by avoiding default. I think it is also in the best interest of Republicans who feel very strongly that the previous debt ceilings that we agreed to when President Trump was here carried us through August. And this current debt ceiling is indeed about the future and not about the past. Obviously, we don't agree with the way the majority has operated this year. We thought the American Rescue Package should not have been passed, creating the kind of raging inflation that Larry Summers correctly predicted. And we certainly think the reckless tax and spending spree is a huge step in the wrong direction for the country. So I believe we've reached here a solution to the debt ceiling issue that's consistent with Republican views of raising the debt ceiling for this amount at this particular time, and allows the Democrats to proudly own it, which they're happy to do.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. The current debt of the United States, according to usdebtclock.org, is just over $29 trillion. And the Treasury Department has estimated that without an increase in the debt ceiling, the U.S. would not be able to pay its bills starting around December 15th. Second day in a row that the stock market has gone up. Dow up 492, NASDAQ up 461, S&P up 95. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer reiterating today that he plans to pass the $1.75 trillion social spending, climate change, and tax bill, known as Build Back Better, before Christmas. Ahead of Senate debate and votes, lawmakers on both sides holding news conference promoting their positions on various issues. A rally on the U.S. Capitol grounds included Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat from New York, who was on immigration, providing a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. It's a provision that the Senate parliamentarian may rule does not comply with the budget process that's being used in the Senate that allows the entire bill to be filibuster-proof. Congresswoman saying today she has a solution to that.
We're done with excuses. We're not here to tell people what we're gonna do. Democrats have a trifecta. We have the House, we have the Senate, we have the presidency. And if we want to do it, we will. We must. We must. We must. Now is our moment. Now is the time to use power. And the reason we're going to do it is because of all of you. If you all weren't here, the possibility would be so much slimmer. But the fact of your presence and your pressure, we have an opportunity to make this happen. So as Chuy said, this is the plan, okay? Porque ese es el plan. Ese es el plan. The initial version of the Build Back Better Act has passed the House. That act has the small parole version, which we don't want to accept. No! But here's the score. There are folks, because the Senate has been aquí allá, because they've been here and there, they don't want to take this huge risk of sending it out when the Senate has been acting the way that it is. So where we are at is that the Senate needs to step up, override the parliamentarian, okay? The parliamentarian is not elected. It is not an elected position. And the parliamentarian has been overridden and dismissed in the past. We will not surrender our power to an unelected parliamentarian. We need to use our power to help the people. And so the Senate, our demand is for the Senate to override the parliamentarian, include a full path to citizenship. And send it back to the House. And we believe that if we send it, and we believe. Ahora. And so we believe that if they send it back, we can get it to pass the House, because after we passed it in the House, we led a letter, Chuy Garcia, Representative Correa, Espaillá, all of our friends over here. I led a letter and 101 House Democrats signed on saying, you send this back, we're gonna get a path to citizenship through the House. So we need to get it done, and with that, I'll hand it back to you all. Pero ahora, ¿cuál es el momento? When is the moment? Thank you.
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at a rally on the U.S. Capitol grounds. Republican Senator John Thune of South Dakota, who is the minority whip, focusing today on another provision in the social spending and tax bill, the $1.75 trillion that's been called Build Back Better. It's a tax deduction that he says unfairly disadvantages his state versus larger states.
One of the most egregious provisions in the Democrats' reckless tax and spending spree bill is lifting the cap entirely, removing the cap, well, I should say not removing it entirely, but raising the cap on state and local tax deduction, because it benefits principally millionaires and billionaires in big, high-tax states at the expense of low-tax states like my state of South Dakota, where we don't have an income tax. So states like South Dakota that don't have an income tax end up subsidizing taxpayers in high-tax states like New York and New Jersey and California, by the way, which are the three biggest beneficiaries of this particular provision in the Democrats' reckless tax and spending spree bill. In fact, Senator Grassley has called the BBB the blue state billionaire bailout. And even Bernie Sanders on the Democrats says there is a limit to the hypocrisy among Democrats in actually advocating in their reckless tax and spending spree bill for a provision that literally provides a huge tax cut for millionaires and billionaires and very little benefit, if any, to middle-income taxpayers.
At Senator John Thune with reporters on Capitol Hill, expected to be a very busy couple of weeks in the Senate as they consider that bill and all the amendments and the procedural votes. You can follow it gavel to gavel on the C-SPAN networks, on C-SPAN 2 television for the Senate, and also on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Politico reports this is technically the last week the House is scheduled to be in session until mid-January, although Speaker Nancy Pelosi has warned members they could return at some point over the holidays if the Senate passes the Democrats' social spending and climate policy bill by then. Top infectious diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci saying the Omicron variant of the coronavirus seems to be less severe than the Delta variant when it comes to illness, but says it would take more time to get a better picture of things. And at the same time, Omicron may be more transmissible than Delta, and also more likely to infect those who have been fully vaccinated. Dr. Fauci, part of today's White House COVID-19 response team briefing.
It's too early to be able to determine the precise severity of disease, but inklings that we are getting, and we must remember these are still in the form of anecdotal, but hopefully in the next few weeks, we'll get a much clearer picture. But it appears that with the cases that are seen, we are not seeing a very severe profile of disease. In fact, it might be, and I underscore might, be less severe, as shown by the ratio of hospitalizations per number of new cases. However, this could be influenced by the fact that many in this particular cohort are young individuals. The hospital stay seems to be less, and the use of supplemental oxygen needs to be less. Again, I caution you, these are still preliminary. Next slide. And then finally, there's the issue of immune evasion. How do you determine immune evasion? If I could have the next slide. There's a study again from South Africa which showed that there is an increased propensity for reinfection among people who were previously infected with Beta or Delta to get reinfected more readily with Omicron rather than with Beta and Delta, giving an indication again without definitive proof that there is a variation and in fact evasion of immunity that is induced by other variants.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Also on today's White House COVID-19 response call with reporters, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, she said that Omicron has now been reported in 19 U.S. states, 50 countries worldwide, and in terms of the United States, she said we expect that number to continue to increase. And this comes as, she said, there's a new surge in COVID-19 cases overall in the U.S., over 100,000 per day. And Dr. Walensky asked by a reporter about some new guidance on at-home testing.
Let's go to Cheyenne Haslett at ABC News.
Hey, guys. Thank you. The new CDC guidelines out last night suggest using an at-home rapid test before indoor gatherings. Dr. Walensky, can you define what that means, when people should be using these tests and how often? For example, should people be using them before they go out to indoor dine, or is it just for larger gatherings?
Yeah, let me just talk about sort of gathering. The first thing I just think we need to reiterate is, you know, the test that as an at-home test can tell you if you have disease right now and whether you might transmit it to somebody else. But the best thing that we can do is to protect from getting disease. So of course that means vaccinating and boosting. That means wearing masks in public indoor settings, especially in areas of high and substantial transmission. What I would say about using the rapid tests is that, you know, when you're practicing all of those prevention interventions and you want to gather together, for example, for the holidays in a multi-generational household, and everybody's been practicing those prevention interventions before you come together, everybody might want to do a test for an extra set of reassurance to make sure that that you can gather safely together. So that's the intent of those updated guidances.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky is CDC director, part of today's White House COVID-19 response team briefing. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines from Air Force Magazine. Leaders from the House and Senate Armed Services Committees unveiling a revised 2022 National Defense Authorization Act today in a bid to overcome gridlock and ensure the passage of the annual policy bill. The new bill combines elements of a version passed by the full House and a version agreed to by the Senate Armed Services Committee, both in September. It also incorporates some of the hundreds of amendments proposed by senators after the committee reported the bill to the full chamber. In recent weeks, the senator struggled to pass its version of the NDAA quickly, with the majority of senators voting against ending debate. And the U.S. Senate voting 68-31 to reconfirm Jessica Rosenworcel to the Federal Communications Commission. The Hill newspaper says it sets the stage for her to make history as the first woman to chair the agency. An article in Newsweek, defendants in the January 6th Capitol riot cases have been complaining about their pretrial detention, as some of them could spend more than a year in jail before they face a jury. A jury trial for oath keepers accused of conspiracy in carrying out the insurrection from nearly a year ago is scheduled to begin this April. It's set to involve those who have been in pretrial detention since their arrest at the beginning of 2021. While a judge raised concerns about the length of their pretrial incarceration, few have been released. That was from Newsweek. Today, a group of House Republicans led by Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia releasing a report titled Unusually Cruel, an Eyewitness Report from the D.C. Jail. Here is Congresswoman Taylor Greene.
What's happening to these people being held in custody is wrong. It's unconstitutional. It's a violation of their rights. And it is an abuse that I call on every single member of Congress to start paying attention to. We need investigations. It's outrageous. The American people are purely upset, disgusted, and cannot believe this is happening in our country. And I think all of us should be appalled. You see, this jail in Washington, D.C. has been known. It's had many reports of being a despicable place as early as 1976. U.S. District Court Judge William Bryant ruled the conditions inside the jail violated the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. In 2015, a report filed showed the jail was plagued by mold, vermin, and water leaks. 2016, the jail had to move 200 inmates because of excessive heat. In November 2021, the Marshals Service found the CDF to be inhospitable. But yet people are still being housed there. But the January 6th defendants are being treated differently on a whole nother level. They have been beaten by the guards. They are called white supremacists. They are denied religious services, haircuts, shaving, the ability to trim their fingernails. There's more outrageous things happening there. They're denied time with their attorneys. They are denied the ability to even see their families and have their families visit there. They're denied bail and being held there without bail. Many of these people have never been charged for a crime before. Some of them are veterans, and the treatment is unbelievable. They are told they have to denounce President Trump. They are told that their views are the views of cult members, even though these are men that every single night at 9 o'clock at night, they put their hand over their heart and sing the national anthem voluntarily. Imagine a group of men being held in jail with no idea of when they're going to go to court, no ability to bail out, no ability to see their family, being mistreated and abused worse than we treat terrorists at Gitmo. Yet they have their hand over their heart every night at 9 o'clock and sing the national anthem. That's something I don't think any of us can fathom. While they're being persecuted by the very government that has the American flag over our buildings, this is completely wrong. Whether we agree, disagree, and I can tell you right now, I completely disagree and am very against the violence that happened on January 6th at the Capitol. We should all disagree with how these people are being treated.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, part of a news conference in Washington, D.C. with a number of other House Republicans. There are about 40 accused Capitol rioters in the D.C. jail out of about 1,400 inmates there total. And overall, about 700 people have been arrested in connection to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Most of those who face charges will plead guilty and never go to trial. President Donald Trump's former advisor Steve Bannon will be going to trial next July 18th, 2022, on criminal charges that he defied a subpoena from the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. And former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows now says that he will not sit for a deposition with that House Select Committee, reversing an announcement he made last week that he would soon appear for an initial deposition. CNN reports that it obtained a letter from Meadows' lawyer citing the Select Committee's subpoena as the problem, the lawyer saying that they were willing to go voluntarily but not under subpoena. U.S. Capitol Police Inspector General Michael Bolton testifying today before Senate Rules and Administration Committee about the Capitol Police and what changes have been made to the agency since the January 6th attack. He's saying not enough has been done to improve security. Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri is ranking Republican on the committee.
Mr. Bolton, we had our last hearing with you. I think it was pointed out that most of the recommendations that you had made up until that time could be done, a majority of them could be done without the police board being involved or without any even additional funds. How many of your, I think now around 104 recommendations have been implemented?
Out of the 104, we have 30.
30?
Yes, sir.
And are you getting significant pushback on the remaining 74?
Not at this time. We haven't gotten any pushback. There may be some the recommendations that we'll have to sit down with the chief and with the board to hash out the very nature of what we're looking for them to make the changes and what they feel also what's comfortable for them.
And your first recommendations were available to them when?
We first issued our first flash report, I believe it was sometime in, was it March?
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it was March, and it was a series that was the intelligence and operational planning flash report, in which they have, as far as the operational plan, they do have that department-wide operational plan now being produced in a singular document.
Do you have regularly scheduled meetings with the department leadership to talk about those recommendations and the implementation of them?
Recently, we have not. I haven't had a meeting with the chief, but I'm sure he's busy with trying to assimilate through with the department and all the other issues he have. I do attend the monthly board meeting, so that there is an opportunity there, and then I do brief the board on a quarterly basis.
So you haven't had a meeting with the chief yet, the two of you?
We've had one meeting. I believe that was back in August when we had our initial meeting.
Are there any recommendations that you've made that you can clearly see resistance in the department?
I believe there probably may be a couple that at least has indicated to me there may be resistance. One is with the CERT teams, the containment emergency response teams, and issues concerning potential with about security clearances. It was one of our recommendations that every sworn and civilian would either have a top secret or, at worst, a secret clearance. There seems to be some hesitation towards moving towards that.
Why do you think that is?
It hasn't been expressed to me directly. I think some of it is having to change your hiring standards. What to do with those who are already on the job that came on a job without that particular hiring standard. And also with whether it be issues that the union may raise. I don't know of any specific ones, but they may. So there may be some concern about what the union may feel about their folks having to get clearances and maintain those clearances. And there's always the fear that once you expend that additional funds, which it is going to be additional funding to get the clearances that you'll have to pay for those, that your individuals may end up leaving to another federal agency with that clearance, because that is a sought-after tool within the rest of the federal government, that if you already have a clearance, then it makes it much easier to move to another federal agency.
How many officers have left the department since January the 6th?
I don't have the exact numbers as far as those, but I believe it's been around 200 or so.
Michael Bolton is Inspector General with the U.S. Capitol Police, questioned by Senator Roy Blunt. Senate Rules and Administration Committee hearing today. Today is the National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. It's the 80th anniversary of the Japanese attack on the U.S. Naval Fleet in Hawaii that led the U.S. to enter World War II. Ceremony today at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. included retired Lieutenant General Claude Mick Kicklighter. He chairs the board of directors for the Friends of the Memorial.
We're here today to pause and to remember and to honor the men and women who 80 years ago were safeguarding our nation at Pearl Harbor and other military installations on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. At 7:53 a.m. on Sunday morning, December the 7th, 1941, without warning and without provocation, the Japanese launched a massive air attack against Pearl Harbor and the other military bases on that island. And when that attack ended, as you've heard earlier, more than 2,400 Americans lost their lives. We gather here today to remember Pearl Harbor and the other installations on Oahu, and honor those who received the first blow, the first strike in World War II, and we remember their families. And also today we remember those who served on the home front. As you've heard earlier by the superintendent, this memorial is truly a sacred place in our nation. It's a place we come to visit. We come to remember those who served and sacrificed. We come to reflect and commemorate the defining moments of that war at this memorial. And as the superintendent also said, we come to learn so that we can reinvest that knowledge in helping keep this nation strong and free.
Retired Lieutenant General Claude McKickleiter at today's ceremony. Earlier in the day, President Biden visited the World War II Memorial. Washington Post reports that the President and the First Lady Jill Biden walked to a wreath at its center point, waved towards the press, and then saluted the wreath. And according to the White House, the wreath contained a wild sunflower, the state flower of Kansas, in honor of the late Senator Bob Dole, who represented that state in the Senate. Dole was awarded two Purple Hearts for his service in World War II. He died on Sunday at age 98. Washington Post also notes that President Biden made the sign of the cross before walking to the New Jersey Pillar of Memorial, where Jill Biden laid a bouquet in honor of her father, Donald Jacobs, who served as a U.S. Navy signalman in World War II. Vice President Kamala Harris marking the White House's first ever Maternal Health Day of Action, inviting lawmakers, cabinet secretaries, and celebrities to discuss the issue. She led off the summit with some remarks about the importance, she says, of this and the steps being taken today.
So today, to kick off this effort, our Department of Health and Human Services and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid are launching a new initiative to designate birthing-friendly hospitals. So this is a brand new designation. And the first designation that rates a hospital based on the quality of its maternal health care. In addition, more than 20 companies and nonprofits have pledged to invest more than $20 million in maternal health efforts domestically and more than $150 million globally. They have pledged to invest in remote care monitors for rural communities, to invest in innovative care models for the postpartum period, to invest in education programs for maternal health providers, and so much more. And we will build on these actions in the coming weeks and months. Now, I know we can all agree, we should all agree, that action is long overdue. We have all heard the stories, and some here have lived the stories. Stories of women who experienced pain only to be ignored. Stories of women who experienced postpartum depression only to be dismissed. Stories of women who had to be put on life support or receive a blood transfusion after blood transfusion and could not hold their newborn baby. These stories should compel all of us to take on this crisis, to change the systems and to challenge the status quo that has created this crisis.
Vice President Kamala Harris speaking from the Eisenhower Executive Office building. CNN notes that a key pillar of the administration's rollout today is centered on money it doesn't yet have. A fact sheet from the administration focuses on the investments written into the House passed version of the president's massive social safety expansion package. The bill, which is stalled in the Senate, would provide a historic $3 billion investment in maternal health aimed at diversifying the perinatal workforce and improving data collection, among other initiatives. That from CNN. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today. And for more top Washington stories, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.